Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Dan, and good afternoon, and thank everyone for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement, Administration of Justice to order, and on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we want to thank you for joining us today for this important commission teleconference meeting. Today, our panelists will focus their testimony on civil rights, oversight, and community engagement. At this time, I'll ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct the roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before we start with the roll call today, I'd like to remind everybody that today's event is open press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in DOJ's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I will call the roll. Commissioner Bowditch.
Deputy Bowditch will try to join in here momentarily.
Commissioner Clemens.
Present.
Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
Present, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
I'm here, thank you, Dean.
Commissioner McDonald. Commissioner Moody.
I'm here, thank you.
Commissioner Parr.
I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
I'm here.
And Commissioner Washington. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. And are there any other announcements, Dean?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. All commissioners should have the bios and testimonies for this panel. And as a reminder, we'll be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. We once again want to acknowledge the work of the commissioners, the working group, our witnesses, and the federal staff toward meeting the goals of this historic commission. And on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and we'll then open for questions from commissioners after the last witness. This is our final hearing. Our first panelist today is Ferrero. I think I've got that right. Fari Khalif. She's the founder and executive director of the Voice of East African Women in Minnesota. Since 2013, Ms. Khalif at the Voice of East African Women has been organizing and advocating for women and youth issues and building bridges between the Somali community and the law enforcement community. She is a survivor of female genital mutilation and has dedicated her life to the prevention of this horrific crime. We're honored to have you here today. Ms. Khalif, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, President Commission, and I thank Attorney General Barr. I am Fahil Khalif, the founder and executive director of Voice of East African Women, and currently I'm the president of St. Paul NAACP, and the second vice president, Minnesota and Dakota's State Conference NAACP. Shall I continue or?
Yes.
Yes. So I'm here today to be a voice as much as I can, the hard work that is we are doing here in the state of Minnesota. Like I said in my statement, this has been journey for me coming from the East Africa all the way to Italy, where I was raised by a Catholic priest and teach me how to put faces of the humanity smiles as much as I can. And the sacrifice that my mom did to snake me out of Somalia to have a better life. And I owe that to my mother, who shortly after I left Somalia, she passed away. And that was many years ago. Every time I think about the hard work I do, I think of her and what would she do today if she was to be alive to see that young girl who did not have a voice. Today, not only she's doing, but she's working hard and advocating for issues and women issues, youth issues, and making sure our voices are heard. I would like to see where, especially Black women in this country, doesn't have a lot of voice when it comes to working hard every day or either doing it, having a company or a nonprofit organization. And that's my hope and always and will be to see the woman leadership and have a voice to be advocating and be included and gender equality. And I always, and I know that many strong women before me always say women's rights is human rights. And as I continue every day, I see the disconnections of our communities here where it comes to the Black communities or the Muslim communities or women, especially immigrant and Black women. How can we build that bridge with the law enforcement? I've been doing that from early on that I moved in the state of Minnesota. Actually, the disconnection was there, the distrust was there. And back in 2013, I created a program I called Mothers Against Youth Recruitment, partnered with U.S. Attorney Office, the FBI, the Ramsey and Hennepin County Sheriffs, and the Police Department, and see the mistrust the community has with the law enforcement. Did not want to engage or want to talk to them because they believe they were out there to get them. I created programs over the years, building that bridge, hoping that the community will come forward and hear the voices of the law enforcement, and vice versa when I reach out to the law enforcement and asking them, I need them to come to the table and speak to the community, especially the women and the young men and women in our communities. I've seen firsthand that when we talk to each other and build that trust, we can do a lot of things together and as a community. And having seen that back in 2017, partnered with Hennepin County Sheriff for 1 year, providing what we call Mothers Women for Peace. We did that for 12 months. We would have hundreds of women and young men and women will come to those meetings. We will do workshops. And things have changed slowly, knowing that the community can see better and understand what the other sides look like. And the law enforcement also understand what the community is struggling with, not just to assume what we're thinking of. And moving forward, as I'm advocating and opening the first shelter for Muslim East African women in the state of Minnesota back in 2017, also gives me the opportunity to get closer to women and their needs for the homelessness when they don't have nowhere to go, we have nowhere to trust. Violence against women is huge. I'm from a community that where violence against women is normal, even though I was one of those young girls when I wouldn't have to go through the female genital mutilation for the pleasure of the man. It's not about the religion. We were told it was about the religion when we were little girls. But coming to the United States, I'm grateful to this nation. I'm grateful to the United States of America giving us the opportunity and giving us a home today, what we call understand the religion and the culture have to be separated. I will not understand something like that if I were being at home today. But the good thing of being in a shelter, giving me advocating for violence against women, teaching women not to be only, it's okay to go to the mosque. Mosque is good. Religion is always wonderful. But what about this land that we live in? It's law and order. We need to go to court. We need to put your rights up, and we need to make sure that you are understanding what you are about to go into this and as a being a free woman, educate yourself. So I can talk about all day long, but and as becoming an NAACP president, I elected after I've been on the board for a few years. I ran for the seat and I won last year, 2019. And I can see why we feel the way we are, especially what we're going through right now in the state of Minnesota and Memorial Day. My hope is to see a couple things. My recommendation is already on my written statement. I hope to see one day we have one more girl has to go through female genital mutilation. We build the trust within the law enforcement communities and the African-American and African immigrants communities, not only the state of Minnesota, but around the country of the United States of America. There's a mistrust in there. There's really a lot of work has to be put in there, and I want the commission to really hardly look at it into that. How can we build that trust? When I keep saying the trust, it's because there's no trust. There's no trust in the black community. We don't feel like there's something that we – there's a lot of good cops, yes, and I work with them closer, and I still do that. But my hope is to you, commissioners, is that we must come together as a humanity to unite it and not to be divided because of the skin of our colors. And every day when we wake up as a community, we go out there and fight. And especially I want to say one more thing is you got to have to look at it. The woman plays a big role in this community. Even though there's a lot of wonderful men out there, I believe if you advocate issues that you care about to build this partnership with African-Americans, look out to those women. Women can make a magic. A lot of things can make that happen. And one day I'd like to see also the United States makes a resolution, hopefully soon, even though March at Women's International Women's Day, to have United States to have a resolution to celebrate, not to be hurt, even though we are hurt, but women come around the world come together and united against violence against women. No woman shall be killed. No woman shall be mutilated. No woman shall be denied because of who she is. And I'm sorry if I'm going over my time, but I want to make sure that small organizations, especially companies and organizations that run black women, be looked at it. And I hope the policies and the way that the grants that is being given to be looked at it, because there's a lot of small organizations out there that run black women that is not given the opportunity and the support that they need. Thank you. I can take some answer questions if you want me. I know I only have 5 to 6 minutes. I apologize if I went over.
Thank you, Ms. Glue, for your courage today and your leadership and certainly your testimony here today. And when we finish, the other panelists will open up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next panelist is President Susan Hudson of the National Association of Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. She's been an independent monitor in New Orleans since 2010, has had a distinguished career in a variety of roles with the Los Angeles Police Department and the Austin Police Department. President Hudson earned her law degree from Tulane University, and we're pleased to have you here with us today. Ms. Hudson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith. I also want to send greetings to you from Abbess Evan Reed and Robin Askew, formerly of the Knoxville Police Commission, Oversight Commission. They send their greetings.
Thank you. I know them well.
On behalf of the membership and the Board of Directors for the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement, I want to express my thanks to Chair Key, Vice Chair Sullivan, the entire commission, and, of course, the Attorney General for this important invitation to speak before the President's Commission on Law and the Administration of Justice. As the President of NACOL, I'm excited to be here to thank also the Department of Justice and especially COPS, and again, Chairman Keith, for your support of NACOL's report on the state of the field of civilian oversight of law enforcement and the effective practices that are enumerated in that report. That report is expected to be published in the next couple of months, and we hope to provide that to this commission for your consideration, as there are many more recommendations therein and we hope the commission will take that into account in their very important work. Effective policing is the goal for all of our communities, and effective policing is built on community trust. If you have turned on the news recently, you have seen the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, front and center. Their deaths show the importance of community trust. How a community reacts to these situations depends on the trust in law enforcement, as you, all of you in those roles are well aware. I and many of my fellow oversight practitioners have been on the streets responding to these officer-involved shootings or in custody deaths as they occur and as we are required to do. And we've seen the results of the lack of trust in law enforcement and policing. So we know these problems. And we have all had to scramble together with community leaders like the prior speaker, police leaders, and others to try and calm very hot situations. Situations that you don't know if there will be a tipping point that leads a community into all-out unrest, as we have seen in some cities. What we know from being in the midst of these incidents is that trust is built before the incident and before the deaths occur. And oversight, the community, and law enforcement have to do that trust-building work together. So if there's one thing I ask for you to take away from my remarks today, is that we in civilian oversight don't think that alone we are sufficient to achieve legitimacy and trust in law enforcement. However, we think that without us, it is difficult, if not downright impossible, in some parts of communities for the police to be able to achieve or maintain the public's trust. In many cases, civilian oversight is established amidst community calls for greater accountability following a high-profile incident, such as Mr. Floyd or Ms. Taylor. Almost all agencies are required by their enabling legislation to conduct outreach to inform the community about policing practices and about how accountability systems work. And we know that there can be no lasting change or lasting trust without community being at the table, as well as the other actors in the criminal justice system. Our member agencies conduct a number of activities to help promote trust in law enforcement. For instance, during this COVID crisis, our organization was reached out to, and many other oversight agencies have the same experience. We were reached out to by over 30 community organizations who were concerned about policing during the COVID crisis. They were concerned about the community's safety, and of course, jailing people and COVID in jails and so forth, but they were also concerned about officer safety and officer wellness as well. We saw what happened in Detroit, we saw what happened to officers in New York, and we were concerned about officers in all of our communities. And so we banded together to work with police about COVID policing strategy. Those were win-win situations for all of us. Oversight agencies conduct Know Your Rights and Responsibilities trainings to the community. Our goal there is to inform the community about how to act during police encounters on the street, where they don't have power. Submit, make it through the experience, and then come talk to us. And then there are things we can do about that. We find that to be a very important function of our agencies, and we do that nationwide. We also support anti-retaliation measures to prevent barriers against police, which keep them from speaking up about inappropriate policing or prevent them from wanting to ask for help when they are in crisis. I read a lot of the testimony for the officer wellness working group and hearing, and I was very impressed by it and very supportive of the help that officers need. Another situation that we had in New Orleans was a past president of our national association and a member of the community who has been involved in oversight of police for decades came to our office and came to the police department and said, "We want to initiate bystander training for police officers." We're like, "What does that mean?" Well, it involves officers teaching other officers about how to intervene in situations where officers may be losing control. and intervene in situations such as what happened to Mr. Floyd in Minnesota. That program is now called EPIC. Ethical Policing is Courageous. And the New Orleans Police Department teaches that all around the country and advocates for that type of cop bystander intervention. And we think that's a very effective training, and oversight helped to bring that about. And community leadership helped to bring that about. We all routinely mediate disputes between the police and the communities they serve. As we said before, the community's power is not on the street. They need to submit, follow instructions, and then come talk to us. And sometimes that initiates complaints, which we mediate, and sometimes we mediate even without complaints. We act as a liaison between our community and our police department in any respect that they need it. So if a victim of crime needs some help reaching their detective, we help them with that. If there's a dispute that needs to be mediated between police and a complaint that needs to be mediated between the police and a community, we also control that structure and make it a safe place for both of them to be able to speak to each other and to work out problems. Some of the most important work we do is making training and tactics recommendations. Now, I know you're all thinking, well, what does a lawyer know about arm bars and other types of force? And what we do is we don't make it up ourselves. We draw on tactics from other police departments, best practices that we see police championing nationwide, and we add our voice to those recommendations. We also keep statistics about officer injuries and way to keep officers safe. I'll never forget my first couple of years in New Orleans, there were more officers shot or killed than the entire time I had been at the LAPD, which had almost 10,000 officers. And what we knew was that officers' training and tactics was so far behind, and we were so concerned for our officers' safety. Those were some of the most important recommendations that we ever made. We know that when officers don't feel safe, our community's not safe. So we do also champion the cause of wellness and safety for officers. Our membership works on a number of things that I'll mention briefly because I know I'm getting over my time, but that the working groups are working on, including social problems, dealing with the mentally ill, juveniles, homeless populations, officer wellness. But one of the most important is data and reporting. One of the three core tenets of police oversight is transparency. Some of our oversight agencies actually publish data for their police departments because they're either unable or unwilling to do so. That is a core tenet of building trust, transparency. When people find out, and they will in the end, about misconduct or bad actions, it's always worse. So when we can put that into context with other data and other information and recommendations, we think that helps to build trust. So we want to continue to support the goals of democratic or community-led policing. We think our role of oversight can help legitimize police actions when we're able to independently validate or not validate those, and we're able to give recommendations on how to make change. And finally, I just again want to express my thanks for this opportunity to address the commission, and we look forward to working with you and looking at your final product as well. Thank you.
Thank you, President Hudson, for your leadership, commitment to service, and for your valued testimony here today. Our last panelist today is Chief of the FBI Crime Statistics Management Unit, Chief Amy Blasher. Chief Blasher joined the FBI in 1995 and has held a number of leadership roles with the FBI and is recognized and acknowledged by her peers in the entire law enforcement field for her achievements. Chief Blasher is in charge of the FBI's uniform crime reporting data and is leading the new crime data modernization initiative in the FBI for the entire country. Chief Blasher, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Director Keith. On behalf of the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Services Division Uniform Crime Reporting Program, I want to thank the Commission for allowing me the opportunity to present this important topic to you today. I look forward to sharing information on the FBI UCR program's hate crime statistics collection to aid this commission in achieving your objectives. Since 1991, thousands of federal, state, county, city, tribal, and college and university law enforcement agencies have voluntarily participated in the hate crime statistics collection. It is the law enforcement officers within these agencies who investigate offenses, determine those motivated by biases, and then report them as known hate crimes to the FBI's hate crime statistics collection. Without their continued support and participation in identifying bias-motivated crimes, the FBI would be unable to publish its annual report on hate crimes. This partnership we have with the national law enforcement community serves as the cornerstone in raising the awareness of the occurrence of bias-motivated offenses. Congress passed the Hate Crime Statistics Act on April 23, 1990, due to an increase in the occurrence of bias-related crimes. The Act required the Attorney General to collect data about crimes that manifest evidence of prejudice based on race, gender, and gender identity, religion, disability, sexual orientation, or ethnicity, including, where appropriate, the crimes of murder, non-negligent manslaughter, rape, aggravated assault, simple assault, intimidation, arson, and destruction, damage, or vandalism of property. The FBI was then tasked with collecting, publishing, and archiving the hate crime statistics. The Hate Crime Statistics Act and its subsequent amendments mandate the types of bias reported to the FBI UCR program. These amendments include the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, the Church Arson Prevention Act, and the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crime Prevention Act of 2009. In addition, changes approved in 2013 by the CJIS Advisory Policy Board added 7 new religious categories: Buddhism, Eastern Orthodox, Hindu, Jehovah's Witness, Mormon, other Christian, and Sikh, and an anti-Arab bias motivation. The FBI UCR program defines hate crime as a committed criminal offense that is motivated in whole or in part by the offender's bias against a race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, or gender identity. I think it's important to also note that even if the offender was mistaken in his or her perception that the victim was a member of the group he or she was acting against, the offense is still a biased crime because the offender was motivated by bias against the group. The FBI's UCR program requires law enforcement agencies to report certain facts about each hate crime incident coming to their attention within their jurisdiction. For UCR purposes, legitimacy of UCR hate crimes incidents are determined through law enforcement investigations and not through the findings of a coroner, court, jury, or prosecutor. The investigation must reveal sufficient objective facts to lead a reasonable person to conclude the offender's actions were motivated in whole or in part by bias. The FBI's UCR program crime data collection begins at the local agency level when law enforcement officers submit administrative and operational data to the records management personnel from either hard copy or electronic incident reports. It is in the local agency records manager who compiles the crime data and submits it to their state UCR program. The FBI relies on local participating agencies to submit all investigated bias crime incidents determined to be a hate crime to the applicable state UCR program, who then forwards that data on to the FBI. Law enforcement agencies are not required by law to report bias or other crime statistics to the FBI's UCR program. As a result, hate crime data, like all other data the FBI UCR program, depends upon the voluntary contributions of these law enforcement agencies. When reliable statistics can be computed, it enables law enforcement agencies to better understand the types of hate crimes occurring in their jurisdictions. This, in turn, assists law enforcement agencies in developing preventative measures to combat these crimes. Furthermore, quality data and statistics help the FBI to provide a national picture of hate crimes to inform, educate, and strengthen communities nationwide. The FBI UCR program serves as a national data collection repository which compiles and publishes this hate crime data received from law enforcement contributors on a yearly basis. I think it's important also to note that the FBI does not analyze or interpret correlations derived from the data. The most current publication, Hate Crime Statistics 2018, was published on November 12, 2019, and can be found on the FBI.gov website. The data is also available on the Crime Data Explorer, or CDE. The CDE is an interactive platform that provides users with easy access to the FBI UCR data. The number of hate crime incidents reported to the FBI decreased slightly from 2017 to 2018. Law enforcement reported 7,120 hate crimes to the UCR program in 2018, which was down slightly from the numbers reported in 2017. The FBI's UCR program is conducting end-of-year verification and validation on the 2019 hate crime data and is actively collecting 2020 hate crime data. The 2019 hate crime publication is set to be released this November. At this time, I would like to discuss the slide that was sent to you depicting hate crime comparisons by, by, bias motivation. The slide shows a five-year analysis of hate crime by bias category and bias type. You can see from the table on the left side, in 2018, there were 7,036 single bias incidents. A percent distribution of single bias incidents shows that 57.5% were motivated because the offender's race, ethnicity, ancestry bias, 20.2% were reported because of the offender's religious bias, 17% motivated because of the offender's sexual orientation bias, 2.4% were reported because of the offender's gender identity bias, 2.3% motivated because of the offender's disability bias, and 0.6% because of the offender's gender bias. I now draw you to the attention of the table on the right. This table depicts the individual bias types for which the FBI UCR program routinely receives the most data or media requests. The reasons for these media requests vary from large reporting increases to current events to academia studies and comparisons. Right now, we can tell you that the preliminary numbers for 2019 show an overall increase in single bias incidents at 10.2%. All bias categories increased, with the largest shown in gender identity and religion. To provide a more precise and transparent narrative regarding the scope, type, and nature of crime in the United States, the FBI's UCR program is transitioning the nation's law enforcement agencies to the National Incident-Based Reporting System, or NIBRS. We are working with law enforcement agencies nationwide to help them transition to incident-based reporting. In fact, the FBI, with the support of the national law enforcement organizations, has established January 1, 2021, as the goal for all UCR contributors to submit their data via NIBRS. At that time, the FBI will retire its historic summary reporting system in favor of the more detailed data collection. So why NIBRS? NIBRS provides a more comprehensive view of crime in the United States and offers greater flexibility in data composition and analysis. When used to its full potential, NIBRS can identify with precision when and where a crime occurred, details about the crime, and the characteristics of its victims and offenders. The richer data submitted via NIBRS provides two important elements, accountability and transparency. In terms of hate crime, the NIBRS eases the law enforcement agency's ability to collect hate crime data as it's included in a record layout versus having to fill out separate hate crime reports, which is the case of the traditional summary reporting system. Law enforcement agencies can use the data to address the concerns of community members regarding crime, and they can use the data when deciding how to allocate resources. In addition, NIBRS provides a common platform for critical data sharing among law enforcement that can facilitate meaningful relationships and partnerships through task forces and interdepartmental collaboration. We work closely with law enforcement agencies across the country to increase participation within the hate crime statistics collection. The Hate Crime Statistics Act is written in a way that makes reporting voluntary. As a result, no participation incentives exist for state and local law enforcement agencies. However, the FBI has engaged in a variety of efforts to make the hate crime statistics collection known to these agencies and to encourage their participation. In closing, we are here to help agencies increase the hate crime participation nationwide. The FBI CJIS Division conducts hate crime training sessions for local law enforcement agencies and records management staff. This training is intended to educate officers on hate crime statistics collection, training them on different hate crime scenarios, and the importance and benefits of reporting hate crime incident data. Again, thank you for the opportunity to address the Commission on behalf of the FBI CJIS Division's UCR program. I look forward to working with the Commission to increase law enforcement agency participation in the UCR program.
Thank you, Chief Blasher, for your informative testimony today and certainly for your service. And let the record show Dean that Commissioner Frazier joined the call.
Yes, sir.
Commissioners, we're now open for questions to the witnesses. Commissioners with a question, please state your name prior to your question and direct the question to a specific panelist or the entire panel. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you. And now, commissioners, with questions for our panelists.
Director, this is Gordon Ramsey.
Commissioner, you're recognized.
This question is for President Hudson. Thanks for your testimony today. I was wondering if you could
talk a little bit about your organization, and do you make recommendations on the best type of review board or items along the auditor arena? And if not, what do you recommend to agencies that are initiating review boards? Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Ramsey. And I think I'm supposed to say my name for the record, Susan Hudson, back on the record. Chief, what we do at NACOL is we do help communities put together oversight and make recommendations for that. We always work with them based on what their community needs are. Some communities want commissions and boards. Some want an auditor or a monitor. So, and one of the things I alluded to in my speech was about this report we have coming out with the help of COPS. In that report, it talks about best practices for community oversight and how to pick that oversight for your community with law enforcement at the table, community, stakeholders, et cetera, to pick which one is best for you. So we've seen cities from, there's a small town outside of Baton Rouge called Port Allen that has literally 16 police officers and they want a commission. They want a commission there. We've seen others where they want a police monitor or a police auditor and they're larger. So it just depends on what your community asks for and your stakeholders ask for. But yes, we do have best practices in what oversight is supposed to look like and what it's supposed to do. And we cannot wait until we can put out this report and provide it to this commission as well.
Thank you. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's really dependent on the community and the community's needs, correct?
Yes. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions? The chair would like to direct a question to Ms. Khalif and President Hudson. When you talk about community engagement, could you articulate a specific example of some of those tactics to engage the community? We hear that term often used, but it's not often well defined.
Ms. Khalifa, would you like me to go first? Or?
Oh,
yes,
yeah,
ma'am.
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay. Again, Susan Hudson. And so we do it in a number of ways in our community and our membership all around the country as well. Sometimes it's a survey. Sometimes it's a listening session at community events. When our oversight was created by and large in New Orleans because of what happened after Hurricane Katrina, before, during, and after Katrina. And we, in 2010, when I got to New Orleans, one of the things we did, we went to listening sessions with DOJ. And we heard testimony from community members about the things that had happened to them. Of course, we take complaints or just listen if people don't want to file complaints. We also will have focus groups. We had a retaliation summit one time that we brought community and police together because there were allegations of retaliation against community and police officers who said they had been retaliated against. So we had that kind of public meeting where we could air grievances and talk about information. And then just most recently during this COVID crisis, we have been engaged in Zoom meetings and conference calls with, like I said, over 30 groups who had questions and concerns about policing. And they can also help us get to people who are affected so we can hear directly from them as well. So it takes a lot of in-person talking and meeting. But we also do surveys and emails, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, President Hudson. Ms. Khalif?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trust is very difficult when experiences like this event that just occurred on the Memorial Day when the African American was killed, the death of George Floyd, by the Minneapolis police officer, that most African Americans and African immigrants already have the distrust on the law enforcement when it comes to history of in our communities, when we see Philando Castile or Jamal Clark or many other African Americans around the country, the distrust is not there. And because of the, you know, we believe that the police is out to get them, even they did nothing wrong. Sometimes addressing this urgent is shall be the priority, and I'm thinking the commission doing that is must be a partnership between the law enforcement and the community leaders from the African American and the African immigrants. I also think the commission should also understand that community leaders are not restricted only the men for the community, most of them. Women are the best source of information about community needs, expectations, ideas, and opportunities. For example, when we created the group that back in 2014 we called Mothers Against Youth Recruitment, are you kidding me? When that was a man coming into the community, you think mother, a woman will listen to the man and try to build this community partnership and relationship with the law enforcement? In my view, I don't think so, but it could happen. So the women were able to successfully develop a partnership necessary between the community and families and the law enforcement that helped mitigate this problem. And then I believe when community, like back in September 26th last year, there was so many violence going on in St. Paul, Minnesota, when a lot of young men gun violence was going on. We, the St. Paul NAACP, organized community engagement with the law enforcement. So we invited the chief of St. Paul Police Department. We invited the Ramsey County Sheriff. We invited the Department of Public Safety Commissioner. We invited the governor's office. We were in the room, and guess what? Also, who else was in the room? The community, over several hundred people was in the community, was in the room. So our hope is to continue the partnership with our law enforcement, because that's the only way our problem can be solved, when community leaders, community members step up to partner with the law enforcement and holding community forums. Partnership is not only just attending meetings, but letting have community families, women, children, fathers to come forward and give them the voice that they need. And it's hard, but I hope that's what I'm hoping that the commission should look at it, to build this partnership immediately, because the trust is not there right now. And we all know what's happening in the state of Minnesota, not only the death of George, which has been horrifically, and we're hoping that justice has been served, but that partnership and community engagement can be built. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clee. Other commissioners with questions?
Director Keith, David Roush.
Commissioner Roush, recognized.
Thank you. This question is for Ms. Hutchison. I'm curious, so typically when we see a civilian oversight conversation kick up, it's always around a controversy. Are there any examples of civilian oversight being embraced prior to controversy? And if so, how does that work? And I think that's something we've got to understand and figure out without waiting for controversy.
Yes, sir, Director Rush. I am not, I can't off the top of my head, cannot give you a number of agencies like that, although I can check on that and get back to you. A lot of times it is a result of some incident, but not all are officer-involved shootings, I'll tell you that. Some are because, for instance, that small town I was talking about near Baton Rouge that once oversight, that is regarding homicides that were occurring and the police were unable to solve them, and the community was upset about that. Another community group in Anne Arundel County in Maryland is also doing the same because of the police reaction to an investigation of a homicide that the community didn't appreciate. So they're not all in custody, that's their officer-involved shootings, but most of them that I'm aware of do usually occur surrounding incidents, but I know there are some that didn't, and I will endeavor to get you that information.
Thank you.
This is Commissioner. Yep, this is Vice Chair Sullivan. I just have a follow-up. Madam Chair, thank you. Am I recognized?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to follow up with that excellent question. Is when those types of community engagements occur, and are they more effective, less effective, equally effective, whether they happen because of an incident or whether they just happen because the community is interested in, you know, pursuing an engagement process like you described?
And Vice Chair, that is a great question. Some of the what we're doing in this report that I keep talking about is looking at what are effective practices and why. And we put a number of examples in that, and we will pull some of that information for you so that we can give you some feedback on what is more effective. Some oversight agencies have had to go through changes, just like all parts of the criminal justice system do. But there are some that have been proactive as opposed to waiting for something to happen, and we will get you information about them and their effective practices.
Okay, thank you. And then, Chairman, if I could just ask one more question.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Of the first panelist, I want to make sure that this doesn't get lost in everything else that was discussed, and that is about female genital mutilation. And you talked about eradicating that in this country. Could you potentially give some more specific instructions? I know this year, for instance, we've put out some money for victim services. DHS has an excellent program that operates at airports. But I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit for us.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chair, I am for life advocating for female genital mutilation. That little girl inside of me, not leaving me alone. So I hope that I do this a lot, and without a funding, I do community forums where I invite the imams and the law enforcement, doctors, and legislators. I did several of those workshops in the last several years, and I'm going to continue doing that. So my hope is just to see that we need more, given more. What I understand is sometimes we call summer cutting. When the school is closed, some community members telling me, yeah, some families are still practicing that. They might send them back home for a couple months and come back. We need to educate our doctors. We need to educate our law enforcement about this issue to understand this is serious, that no child, no little girl has to go through this, no matter where she is in the world. And the United States of America is already is illegal. Even the state of Minnesota still is illegal, but it's not enforced. When it's not enforced, people can still practice. They think it's a religion, but I think it's a cultural. And I know every year, once a year, when the month of March, every woman around the world was stopped by New York, the United Nations. If the United Nations or the United States, and here this country can give a resolution, the month of March 8th will be Female Genital Day. We can call celebration or awareness. Every woman shall travel to come here and to condemn this practice no matter where she is in the world. It can be in Africa, it can be Asia and Europe, and North America. And it's a mental health, it's a long-term effect in the short term. And I know the state of Minnesota, I advocated back in 2017 to force more where a woman cannot practice this no matter where she is. Even she can take this little girl back to Africa or whatever side of the world she's from. But when she comes back here, she has to be persecuted to the max. And even the bill that it has a harsh language, even she will lose her children. My hope is you, the commission of the president and commission, to understand that female genital mutilation is still being practiced to stop, but also make it stronger. And I'm sorry, I have this funny accent that sometimes I get excited when I talk about female genital mutilation because I know it's wrong. I know no girl shall go through this. And I hope that the commission will consider to implement somehow, some way to become Female Genital Awareness Day in the United States every March every year, once a day, the whole world shall come and celebrate and give this awareness to parents. And once the parents get for the awareness, so they don't have to go to jail. They don't have to lose their children. They don't have to, and I'm supporting that. And I supported Representative Mary Franson in Minnesota, and even though that appeal did not go through the Senate, and I'm still advocating with her that one day mothers will stop practicing this horrific ritual female genital mutilation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions?
Mr. Chair, this is James Small. Would I have a question?
Yes, Commissioner, you're recognized.
This would be for the folks from Nicole. Just a question. In your curriculum, when you help folks start up a new oversight agency or advising an existing one, to what level of engagement do you recommend they have with the representative bodies of those police departments? It seems like those representative bodies, like the Fraternal Order Police or police officer associations, always seem to be villainized by those arms of oversight. And I'm just wondering what Nicole's recommendation is for those folks that they're advising on startup or just regular running.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, we, number one, it's always about what the community wants. And we police officers are part of the community, so we always encourage them to be at the table for anything that's being put together. Of course, we don't control those cities, but when we come in, we will teach to whomever the cities put together as a part of trying to create oversight. We'll talk to mayors, FOP, any other associations, community groups. And the core tenets of oversight are just that, and we want to teach them and spread them far and wide to all. And we know that the it will not be a success if officers are not at the table. We know that, like, for instance, our mediation program, when we put that together, we invited all, there are three police associations here in New Orleans, and we invited them all to the table to be a part of it, and two took us up on the offer, and we feel like our mediation program is truly community created because of that. So we absolutely recommend that the police be at the table to, you know, express their opinions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony, and certainly the responses to the questions from commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Avita, and all the commissioners here today, your contributions provided will be sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website. We update it regularly when information is made available for posting. But we want to thank the FBI. Thank you. We want to thank the FBI for their continued use of the teleconference network and support, and certainly the federal programming staff that supports the commission. Any questions or comments from commissioners?
Mr. Chair, this is Gordon Ramsey.
Yes, sir. You're recognized, Commissioner.
In light of the events going on in Minnesota, I just wanted to talk real quickly about, or see if we could get an update on our potential working group that's focusing on use of force. Do we have any commissioners that are in that working group that are on the line, or can we talk a little bit about that and the commission?
Commissioner, there's not a specific policy working group on use of force, but we can certainly ask the working group, the training working group, to consider that issue.
I think that would be great and important as well.
Mr. Davis?
Yes, sir, and Will. I think I heard another commissioner.
Do you have...
Okay, if not, Commissioner Ramsey, we'll certainly take that under advisement and talk to the training working group.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from commissioners?
Chairman, this is Commissioner Hawkins.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chief. Yes, ma'am. Commissioner, you're recognized.
Is there another presentation from any SMEs regarding the civil rights and or oversight coming up soon?
Yes, sir. We're making we're making diligent efforts to get invitations out and getting other panelists lined up on the oversight and community engagement, which will include civil rights.
Thank you. That was all I wanted to know.
Other questions or comments from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. And thank you again, commissioners, for your continued dedication and commitment.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's presentation. You may now disconnect.